That's the beginning of Nonea, a composition by saxophonist Roscoe Mitchell that's easily one of his best-known pieces, and this particular performance, which lasts over 20 minutes, comes from the album Nonea, which is a landmark in avant-garde jazz and improvised music. Mitchell has also recorded this piece with the Art Ensemble of Chicago, which he founded. Other artists have covered it, and he recently performed a full orchestral arrangement of it in Glasgow, Scotland. Of course, Nonea is just one piece of hundreds in Roscoe Mitchell's catalog. He's been making music since the mid-1960s, when he and several other artists formed the AACM in Chicago. His most famous group, obviously, is the Art Ensemble of Chicago. In 2017, they've done performances, or are doing performances, in New York, Philadelphia, and London. And as you'll hear in this interview, there are plans in the works for a larger celebration of the group's 50th anniversary in 2019. So I thought there would be no better artist to interview for the very first Burning Ambulance podcast. I guess I should explain why Burning Ambulance is launching a podcast at all, and there's really a very simple explanation. The site has been around since 2010, and I've always loved interviewing artists and wanted to do more of it, but like every professional journalist in the world, I absolutely hate transcribing interviews. So I decided to concentrate on getting the best quality recordings I could of my conversations with artists and just share them that way. So this interview was taped about a week before the Art Ensemble played New York. That show was on October 6th. I saw them at their previous New York show, which was 13 years ago in 2004. That time, you can hear it on the CD Non-Cognitive Aspects of the City, which is on the Pi Recordings label. The group at that point included Roscoe Mitchell and Joseph Jarman on reeds, Famidou Danmoye on drums, Corey Wilkes on trumpet, and Jaribu Shahid on bass. Both Malachi Favors and Lester Bowie, the group's original bassist and trumpeter, were dead by the time I got to see the Art Ensemble for the first time. This time, at this October 6th show, it was Mitchell and Moyer representing the original lineup, with Hugh Reagan on trumpet, Tamika Reed on cello, and Junius Paul and Jaribu Shahid both playing bass. And midway through the performance, Joseph Jarman joined them, not to play saxophone, but to read some of his poetry, which was great. It had this kind of incantatory Zen thing going on that really gave the whole performance, the whole occasion, a sort of ritualistic feel. So, in any case, let's get started. Here is a short excerpt, though, before that, from Discussions 2, which is from Roscoe Mitchell's newest album, Discussions. This was recorded with a large ensemble, and the music is based on transcriptions of improvisations from the two Conversations albums he made with Craig Taborn on keyboards and Kikanju Baku on percussion. Improvisations from those albums were taken and transcribed for orchestra, and the result is this new album, which is really pretty amazing stuff. So here's a little bit of that, followed by my conversation with Roscoe Mitchell.
Yeah. My first question is a general one. Why do you think you became a musician?
Well, I mean, I would say that my older brother Norman, you know, kind of like got me interested in music and so on. I mean, I'd listened to music before, don't misunderstand me, but my older brother Norman, what he had in those days was all of these 78 records and so on, and they used to call these records killers, and they would have these big stacks of these 78 records, and he would sit me down and play these records for me, you know. And I think that kind of got me interested. I consider myself to be like a late starter, because I started to play the clarinet when I was in high school, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was about 13 years old. So, but yeah, that's basically how I got interested. I had listened to a lot of music in the church and also on the radio. In the radio, back in those days, a radio station would play a wide variety of music throughout the day. Not so much like now, where one radio station is dedicated to playing a certain thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to me, and this is true, I also hear this in other AACM players like Wadada and Anthony Braxton, that silence and space are as important to you as sound. So was that always the case, or did you start out as a young man wanting to play everything and sort of only gradually start letting more air in?
Well, what I think about silence is that it's perfect. So when you interrupt silence, you're striving to be on the level, on that same level, you know, with when you produce a sound. So, but yeah, silence is 50% of music, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, that's the way I view it. You know, I mean, I've done exercises where, you know, you're just doing short bursts of sounds, and then, you know, trying to come in on the same level as silence, you know. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to ask a few questions about the art ensemble, obviously. Each member of the original, you know, five-member lineup, at any rate, had a look. And to put things bluntly, you were sort of the normal one. No robes, no lab coat, no face paint, you know. Did that translate to your musical role in the group as well, do you think?
Well, I don't know about that, but you said I was what now?
Sort of the normal one. You were wearing like a jacket and tie.
No, but you said in terms of the art ensemble. Actually, the art ensemble is an outgrowth of a group that I started in Chicago. I don't know if you've heard some of those early Nessa records, when the group was called the Roscoe Mitchell Art Ensemble.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I was asking is, you know, how did the visual component line up with the musical ideas that each member was bringing in, I guess?
Well, the art ensemble actually is a group of five individuals, you know, and each person brings their own individuality to the group. So it's always a learning experience, you know, in working with the art ensemble. I mean, of course, people could dress like they wanted to dress, and I chose to dress like I wanted to dress, you know. Mm-hmm. I tried to paint my face one time, but then when I was sweating, you know, it was a problem. So I decided I didn't want to do that. So I guess because some guy told me at a concert, he said, you know, wow. I was listening to the music and it took me out into outer space. He said the only thing that made me know that I was on Earth, you know, was when I looked at you and seeing you, how you were dressed and so on, you know. So, but yeah, the art ensemble is a group of five individual musicians and thinkers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the recent biography of the group that was released, it's very detailed when it comes to all of the five members' early lives and all of the group's music and activity up to about 1974. But then after that, it kind of fast forwards through a lot of stuff to my, you know, to me as a reader. So I'm wondering, to your mind, do you think people took the group for granted in some ways in the 80s and 90s when you were an established thing?
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that much. I mean, like, it seems like all of those records got a lot of attention. Oh, you mean in the 80s and so on?
Yeah. I feel like a lot of people know Urban Bushman, but I'm not sure that the other ECM records are as discussed as your, you know, Parisian albums
I can't
and stuff
answer
like that.
Question. That's up to critics. I mean, you know, the records are out there, you know, so I don't know if I have the answer to that question.
Mm. Yeah.
But I mean, hey, if you want to write about it, that would be great. Say that about it, you know, so yeah.
Yeah, well, that was, I mean, that's where the question started from, was because I feel like that book that came out recently about the group kind of started fast forwarding after 1974. So,
well, I mean, it's going to take a few books to really document everything the Art Ensemble has done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would be my estimation. You know, there's that's one book, you know, along with that author. Whenever I get the time, you know, I'm going to get together with him and, you know, write down, you know, the journey of my composition, No Name, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That started out as a piece for solo saxophone. You know, I had set in front of myself the task of writing five pieces for solo saxophone, and then my original thought for Nonea was I wanted to write a piece that would make the saxophone sound like it was more than one instrument. So what I had in my mind was exploiting the different registers of the saxophone with wide interval skips and leaps at a rapid pace to give that impression. And that piece started out as a piece for solo saxophone. And then I think it was in 2016, maybe, or 15, or I don't know. I mean, I can't keep up with the dates, but I was there in Glasgow, Scotland, with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and Ilan Bokov conducting, and I premiered the full orchestra version of that piece. So at some point, I'd like to sit down and write a book about that. You know, a lot of people have written about the piece. As a matter of fact, Paul Steinbeck wrote a whole paper on just the solo from the Willisaw Festival. Do you know that solo?
Yeah, actually, it's funny you should bring this up, because Nonea was actually the next thing that I was going to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
What is the strength of that piece to you that allows it to work in so many ways? Because you did it, the Art Ensemble did it, some people have covered it on their own albums, and a few years ago you did, there was an evening performance in Seattle, which was about five versions by different groups. A friend of mine mm-hmm. was there and wrote about that performance.
Yeah, have you seen the videos from there?
I have not, no. So what is it about that piece that allows it to be that sort of open-ended and work in so many different interpretations?
Well, I wish I could tell you the answer to that. You know, sometimes you can sit down and write and then boom, it just comes right out. And that's what happened with that piece. I told you what my parameters were for the piece, you know, trying to capture exploit the three registers of the saxophone to get the instrument to sound like more than one instrument. Shortly after that came the saxophone quartet. After hearing the slow section of the saxophone quartet, it reminded me of strings. So I was talking to my friend, the genius composer Primus Fountain III, and I told him that I was thinking of doing a piece for a string quartet. And he suggested that, well, you did it for four alto saxophones. How about
four of the same string instrument. And that made sense to me. So the saxophone quartet was intended to sound like a big saxophone, you know, in the way that the four saxophones were seated and the way that the music was being passed around between them. So I then did a completely notated version of the piece for four cellos.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what I consider Nonea to be is like it's kind of a system, you know, that I've created, so that if you were to say to me like, oh, you know, I need an arrangement of Nonea, you know, and I need it for in a couple of days, that would not be a problem for me. But then I what I do too in my work is that I'll spend a lot of time on something, you know, and that allows, and then when I work on my music, I do that too, because I try to get under the surface of things, you know, and then they start to reveal themselves to you. So I guess that's kind of like the case with Nonea, you know, and some other pieces that I've done too, you know, that I've expanded them in different ways. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How much of the Willisaw performance that's on the Nonea album, how much of that was a response to the feedback you were getting from the audience? Did you walk onto the stage expecting that performance to go down the way it did?
No, not necessarily. I mean, the thing is that the art ensemble was at the festival. The art ensemble had played. Anthony Braxton was supposed to be coming to the festival. There was something with his travel or something where he couldn't get there, and so the audience was there to hear Anthony Braxton. I mean, I wanted to hear him my own self, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there was that resistance, you know, that happened at the beginning, you know, and Paul Steinbeck, I also have his article that I could send you. He talked about that performance, but what it was exactly like I just said, you know, there was some resistance of people, so I chose to, music is a science, you know, and I always knew that, so I chose to do that repeated figure over and over until the audience decided to relax and let me finish playing the solo. So, that was kind of what happened with that, you know. People expecting to hear Anthony Braxton, and there I am. Nicholas Strockler had asked me to do the solo in place of him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have there been other occasions in your career where the audience reaction has shaped the music in that kind of a way?
I'm open for whatever happens myself. I think I fare better. Like, let's say I did real good today, and I'm going to go out there and try to do that again the next day. That doesn't work that well, you know. I think it works better for me when I'm open to, what's going on in the moment, and when I can get into that. It always works better, you know, because I want to be in the moment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, speaking of Anthony Braxton, the album of duets that you guys did in the 70s was just reissued on CD for the first time about a couple of weeks ago. And he also appears on the Nonea album and on The Maze from around that same time. So how do you feel that your voices, both as instrumentalists and as composers and sort of thinkers about music, how do you feel your voices mesh?
Well, I mean, we all mesh, you know. None of us sound like each other, you know, but we still mesh. And we spent a lot of time in Chicago doing a lot of concerts together and rehearsing and so on and so on and so forth, you know. Music is no thing that happens by chance, you know. You have to put in the work, you know. If you put in the work, then, well, what it is with the ACM, we've had lots of rehearsals, you know, over the years. So when we come back together, you know, to play, it's kind of, we just pick up from where we left off, You know, if Anthony called me in the next 5 minutes and said, oh, can you come over here and do a duet with me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure, I can do that. Yeah.
Now, another performer that you guys, that the Art Ensemble worked with, but only on a couple of occasions, you did a big concert in Paris with Cecil Taylor in the 80s, and then did an album together in 1990, I believe. I'm curious how you found a middle ground there, because I've examined some of Taylor's scores, because I met with him last year. And they don't seem like a methodology that the Art Ensemble would employ. They seem very different. So where was the creative junction point for you?
Well, the creative junction is music, right? If I was doing music with you, your score wouldn't have to mesh, you know, with me. I mean, what I would expect from you is that you tell me what you're expecting from your score. As a musician, I should be able to... You make my job easy when you do that. If you told me, well, okay, over in this section, I want you to play blue, you know,
mm-hmm.
or red or green, well, then, hey, I like that, you know, because then I'm not having to try to make up, you know, what it is you'd like to see happen with your composition. So it makes my job easier, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At that point, when you guys first were, when you were working together on the Parisian concert in 83, 84, Cecil had embraced an element of theatricality in his own group with, he had like percussionists pacing off the stage and dancers and things like that. So did that make it more of a complementary situation since that element of theater had always been present in the Art Ensemble's music?
Well, I think what it is like people just wanting to, and it's starting to get back to that, you know, like a long time ago, there were several concerts like with dancers, live music, dancers, poets, you know, art exhibits, so on and so forth. I see a kind of a people coming back to that, you know, now. I mean, people want to do that again. So it's just like, you know, it's just common interest. It's a common interest. For me, I mean, if you're playing an instrument, and then all of a sudden you jump off into theatrics or you know, or some kind of acting or whatever. Hey, if I like that, I want to know what that is. You know, I'm curious. So I mean, I think that's the thing that the thread that binds, you know, people together of that have the same like. Of art and exploring it in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, when you guys made the record together in 1990, it was split across several recording sessions, like multi-day sessions, I think, so, which is atypical for, you know, jazz or improvised music sessions, which are typically a single day. Why was it such a...
Well,
such
that's
an,
not always true. Yeah, I mean, you know, people that's trying to run down a fast budget or something like that, you know, then yeah, you get that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then sometimes, you know, too, you can go in the studio and do it like in a day. My Conversations records, I did those in, two days, I think it was, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, none of this is like by chance, though. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to say that again because my experience is that, hey, I put in a lot of hours, and I'd like to put in a lot more right now. I mean, you know, this is a very important time in music.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that Cecil record, you guys were, it wasn't that you were at creative impasses or anything. You were actually pushing through ideas, you know.
Absolutely.
Now, my next question is sort of complex, I guess, but I mean, if, you know, the AACM has been extremely influential in turning jazz, and you should assume quotation marks there, into concert hall music and music with academic backing. And the Art Ensemble has always been about mixing music from all levels, again in quotes, vernacular sounds as well as sort of high art music into one big thing, like everything, you know, like all sounds are permissible, all sounds are welcome, kind of a thing. But I wonder if you feel like in your solo work there's no longer as much reward from promoters or from audiences in embracing vernacular music as there is in the more rarefied sort of music. Like if you wanted to put together a band to play bebop and standards,
I don't think I'm going to want to be doing anything like that.
Right. I'm saying I don't think there would be the reception there as there would be for the stuff that you're doing now. And so,
well, I mean, that's, you know, like they had the Young Lions, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they took over Europe and now they're not as popular as they were. You know, the people that I admire in music are the ones that, you know, we're playing the music of their time, so to speak, you know, because when you put it on, then it's always new and fresh, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from life, you know. I think it's kind of difficult to be somebody else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're always waiting around to see what somebody else is going to do, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to put you behind, right? If I'm sitting around waiting to see what you're going to do, I'm going to be behind you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm probably never going to be you as good as you can be you, you know. That's the thing that's unique about us. We all can be ourselves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's easier to be yourself. It really is, you know. It's easier to be yourself. Music and that comes before you is there for you to study and so on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They said that Charlie Parker used to sit around and listen to Lester Young, you know, I mean, you know, he'd go and outside the door and listen to Lester Young. They don't sound anything like each other. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There's no resemblance of what they're doing, I mean, to each other than they were working out of a certain structure of music, you know, that they were doing. Same thing with Johann Sebastian Bach. You know,
mm-hmm.
You get into Johann Sebastian Bach's set of mathematics that he was using in his music. Somebody might say, hey, you know, you sound like Johann Sebastian Bach, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't even desire to be like anybody else. Matter of fact, if you come and see me playing, please come and tell me, oh, hey, man, you sounded like so-and-so or such-and-such, you know? I'm not even trying to be that, you know. And then, nor am I trying to be a musician that has isolated themselves off into some category, you know. I much more prefer just to study music, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Several of the records that you've put out in the last 10 years or so, let's say, Bells for the South Side, Discussions, the one that just came out, and also a one that I just got from ECM a few years ago, which is the Improvisation Composition 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
Those all feature like larger ensembles, anywhere from 9 to like 19 players. Are you mm-hmm. generally thinking in larger terms these days? Is that
I take whatever's there. You know, if you came to me and say, "Hey, I need a solo piece," what I'm doing is taking whatever element that I'm presenting and trying to present it so that everything is there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whether it's one person or 100 people, you know, I'm making sure that I've got all the musical elements intact so I'm able to present the whole picture. So I don't think of it like that. It just so happens. So I mean, I've done like 4 or 5 major orchestra performances this year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't I guess I put things in place for it to happen, maybe. I don't know. I mean, like Ilan Volkov had contacted me about coming to Glasgow, Scotland the first time, and what I did was what I told you. I presented Nonea in the full orchestra version. I had did different arrangements of it, orchestrations, you know. But I hadn't, some of these were like chamber settings and so on, so I didn't have like full-blown brass and full-blown percussion and so on and so on and so forth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he got in touch with me and asked me to come to Reykjavik, Iceland, I did not want to go there with that same piece, so I started to think, oh, well, I better come up with something where I can generate a lot of pieces, you know. So that's when I got the idea to find people to transcribe the improvisations off my conversations records.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then Paul Steinbeck was the first person I went to for that, and he turned me on to brilliant people, you know. So and then generating that whole process, you know. Thank God, I'm glad I did that, because I didn't know I was going to get all of these orchestra performances.
Yeah, yeah. And how much input did you have into shaping the transcriptions and the orchestrations that they came up with?
It's an ongoing improvisation, as much as I need. I mean, it's like, you know, if I ask you to come and be the soloist on one of these pieces, what I'm basically saying to you, Phil, come over here and be the soloist. I would like you to come and improvise with Craig Tabern, Kai Kanju Baku, and myself. Basically, that's the basic fundamental there, because that's really what it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at They Rode for Them, which was originally a duet for bass saxophone and drums, the first orchestration for that was, I used the drum part to create the orchestration for the orchestra. I removed myself off bass saxophone and reinserted myself on sopranino saxophone as an improviser. The following month, I went to New York and I used the bass saxophone part to create an orchestration that featured Sarah Schoenbeck on bassoon as the soloist. You see, so it's ongoing. And not to mention also that some of the people that have done these transcriptions, like a couple of my former students, Christopher Luna and Daniel Steffi, not only did they want to orchestrate, to transcribe, they wanted to orchestrate also, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, I take them with me, you know, to these performances, you know, and they get a chance to communicate directly with the conductor about what it is they want with their piece. It brings another type of variety to the project. So you see, it's ongoing, you know. I'm at the first base or whatever, you know, with this process right now, you know.
Yeah.
So I just finished a performance at the D. Young Museum here in San Francisco with a 34-piece chamber orchestra. The orchestra that you heard on the discussions record, that was the first version of that orchestra. That was about 18 people. This orchestra was 34
mm-hmm.
people.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, so it's ongoing. I mean, ongoing. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The piece Bells for the South Side. There's a piece on your album Numbers from a few years ago called Bells from New Orleans. Is there a direct connection between those? I believe William Wine.
No, you're thinking of another piece. You're talking about Bells for New Orleans.
Yes.
That's a piece that was commissioned by Sylvia Smith. It's because she put out a book called Summit that had all of these solo pieces for orchestra bells or glockenspiel, you know. And So I wrote that piece, Bells for New Orleans, and then later on I did a prelude and postlude to that piece for tubular bells, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's recorded both by William Why Not and also by a percussionist. Let me grab that record, hold on. Yeah, his name is Brett William Dietz, I believe it is, D-I-E-T-Z.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on his record called Noctrum. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's the piece you're thinking about. The piece you're talking about is for solo glockenspiel, right?
Yeah, and so I was curious whether there was a connection between Bells for New Orleans and Bells for the South Side, which is on your recent ECM record.
No, not necessarily. Bells for New Orleans is because of Katrina, you know, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Bells from the South Side was like, I lived on 59th between State Street and Lafayette. 59 in Princeton was a church there that had a bell that used to go off in the tower, you know, and we listened to it growing up, you know. So that piece was influenced by that.
Oh, okay, okay. So when you're composing a piece and or organizing an ensemble, what is the balance that you strike in a sort of chicken-egg sense, I guess? Do you decide which musicians you want or which instruments and then figure out how the piece is going to work, or is it sort of vice versa?
Well, a lot of times the pieces that I do are like commissions and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like I'm going to be doing a piece for the Ensemble Contemporarian, which is the orchestra that Pierre Boulez put together to
mm-hmm.
play his music. And other composers' music. Man, if you go and look at these folks' instrumentation, it is like, whoa. They could either have five pianos or several of this instrument or several of that or what, you know, on and on and on and on and on. So, in that case, I've gone to their site and looked them up and see what's available. You know, and all of these folks are supposed to be spot on readers and so on. So, you know, I go in with that, you know, on my mind, you know. But a lot of pieces are commissions. Like right now, I'm working on a commission for Anna Ray. She wanted a piece for solo vibraphone, you know. I've got things that I want to write too, you know. Most recently, it's been these conversations for orchestra pieces, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got one of my students is now working on a piece off of my solo record from São Paulo, Sustain and Run. Do you know that record?
I know of it. I haven't heard it, but I know of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what I want to do with that record is get some transcriptions of some of those solos, and then I want to create a whole list of compositions for strings, you know, solo string pieces, string quintets, string quartets, string orchestra pieces, you know, so, and it'll probably go on further than that because I can do things for strings and piano or strings in this instrument or, you know, so on and so on and so forth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's been most recently, people will commission things.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I have a couple more questions about the art ensemble, the first of which is when you reunited the group in 2004 with Corey Wilkes and Jaribu Shahid as members, that was the first membership change effectively since 1968, I think. So how much were they there as new voices, creatively speaking, or in your mind, were they filling absent members' spots?
That's impossible. There's never going to be another Lester Bowie or Malachi Favors or Joseph Jarman or Famadou Danmoye or Roscoe Mitchell, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even look at it like that. I mean, it's some totally different. I mean, all the great musicians that, you know, have passed and someone takes over their legacy and, keeps the band going on and so on. It's, you know, I mean, I think everybody still wants people to be themselves and so on, you know. And right now I'm planning to do, I'm starting to plan for the Art Ensemble's 50th anniversary, which is going to be in 2019. And I'm thinking of ensemble somewhere around 12 people, you know, because I want to have strings, because we want to do like tributes to Mellicott Favors, tributes to Lester Bowie, tributes to Joseph Jarman, you know. So, I mean, you're going to see a little bit of that kind of thing start to happen in New York, you know, when we're there. It's like that. I mean, I think that's what I really appreciate about the Art Ensemble. You know, I've got a chance to work with people, you know, that were visionaries, you know, and I'm just kind of like, I think I'm lucky to have been around with these kind of people and to be able to share in that vision, you know. It's always like being around those kind of people, it's always a learning experience, you know. So, yeah.
So for the New York performance and then the stuff that you're talking about that's coming up in the future, it's an sort of a continuing exploration of, you know, the sort of sound world that you guys created, but bringing in new voices and things like that. So it's not, because, you know, there's this tradition in certain areas of jazz, you know, of like ghost bands, you know, like there's still a Glenn Miller orchestra, you know, stuff like there's still a Count Basie orchestra, stuff like that, but that's not, you know, the kind of thing that the Art Ensemble would ever have been. So I'm curious, you know, about that.
No, that don't even desire to be that. But I mean, you know, it's a difference. I mean, like I would like to keep learning about music and keep going forward. I mean, I'm not the best person to do a cover of my own self, you know. I'm not really thinking about that much. Putting together this 50th anniversary, honoring, you know, the members of the Art Ensemble, you know, putting different arrangements and things on their pieces and so on like that. Not even that interested for it to be like the Art Ensemble at all. I want it to be something that is what it is, you know. And speaking of things, I just got an email from Dana Reason. They sent me Nonea mix of my trio. They did it in Portland. It was the one for flute, bassoon, and piano, and it's, they did it with oboe and flute and piano. So I'm getting, wow, now I've got a whole new thing to listen to here. And so you see this Nonea thing. I mean, I never thought it was going to be a ride like this. But it goes on and on and on. You know, all I'm doing right now is just gathering all the materials and things on it, you know. And then, like I said, when I get a time that I can sit down, I want to figure out how to do it, because I have all of these different scores and different versions of the pieces, all the things that people have written about the piece, the dissertations and so on that people have written, and so yeah, on and on and on. You never know. I mean, like it's just like you know, if somebody says "Heidi, Heidi, ho," you know, who are you gonna think about? You know, Cab Calloway.
Yeah.
You know, so so when somebody thinks about Nonea, they're gonna think about Roscoe Mitchell. You know, so but Eddie Harris always told me. He said, "Look, don't ever get a hit, man, because wherever you go, people always want to hear that, you know." But I mean, he had a very special thing, you know, happening where, you know, he could actually sell some records, you know. I mean, you know, People and Exodus and all those pieces and so on. And then one night I was in Canada listening to Eddie Harris, and he was playing a ballad, and somehow you knew at some point Eddie Harris was going to hit this high note, and he did that. And when he did it, it almost like cut the air in the room, and then he just kind of glided on back down to the end of the piece, you know. Yeah, I'm inspired by people like that. I mean, Eddie Harris, I mean, you know, what an amazing musician, you know. and what he did, you know, and so on like that. It goes on and on and on and on and on, you know. I'd like to somehow be in that crowd of people, if I could be, you know. I really feel like now I'm wanting to really get back into having my time, you know, so that I can have these long days of practicing and writing and so on and so forth like that. Kind of like disappear for a while, you know, and do that kind of thing, you know. So,
I'm curious about that actually a little bit. Is what is a day like for you? Because you're describing, you know, having all these commissions, and obviously you're probably, you know, rehearsing to a certain degree for the New York show next week, and you know the Philadelphia show after that. So how much of your day is devoted to music, and how much of it is devoted to, you know, everyday life or academic stuff, because you're still out at Mills?
I'm not looking for everyday life, but what you described at first, I mean, that's devoted. I'm 100% devoted to music, you know. To me, I'm good, you know, if I, like, get up early, work hard on my music, dinner time comes, I have dinner, then pretty soon after that I'm going to bed, you know. And then I'm getting up again early, you know, when I'm fresh after I've slept, you know, the whole night, you know, and I'm gonna go back to my music, you know. So music is it's 100% job or something like that. I mean, you know, even when you're not doing it, you're thinking about it, you know. If I'm writing, you know, and I wake up, oh, you know, then this is in my head. So then a lot of times I'll just get up, you know, and go to work, you know.
Okay, that was my interview with Roscoe Mitchell, and that concludes the first Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed that enough to come back for the next one. Thanks a lot.